Today is Tuesday, January 28th, and this is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, at least five people in Australia have tested positive for coronavirus.
Australia is also bracing for a slump in visitors from China, its biggest international tourist market.
Also ahead, protests in Gaza over U.S. President Trump's Israel-Palestine peace plan. It's all on today's International Edition. Our top story today, deaths from the coronavirus outbreak in China have topped 100 with over 4,500 total cases. But alongside the human toll, economists are beginning to worry about economic impacts. Transportation has been cut off to many Chinese cities at the height of the Lunar New Year, and Hong Kong said Tuesday it will cut all rail links to mainland China. Chinese financial markets were closed for the holiday, but stock indexes in Tokyo, Seoul, and Sydney all declined. Prices of gold and bonds rose as traders moved money into safe haven holdings. The Shanghai Stock Exchange, one of the world's busiest, announced it was postponing the resumption of trading after the holiday by 3 days to Monday. Meanwhile, foreign nations are preparing to evacuate their citizens from Wuhan, which is the center of the outbreak, while international companies are drawing down staff. Jason Yin, an economist at Seton Hall University in New Jersey, says businesses dependent on the Lunar New Year holiday, when Chinese citizens travel, dine, and buy gifts, will be hardest hit.
It mainly affects the travel, tourism, entertainment business. It has a less restaurant, hotel consumption, less traveling by air or by train. During the Spring Festival in China, there was a lot of consumption of restaurant and hotel, and also have a lot of traveling. So that create a lot of revenue. But on the other hand, it's a vacation time for about 2 weeks. So the most manufacturing company will close down their factories. So on the one hand, cause a lot of loss in business, but on the other hand, have a relatively minor impact on the manufacturing and the production.
The biggest question for China's broader economy, though, is how long the outbreak will last. SARS didn't tamp down until the end of the second quarter, when temperatures rose higher and the virus could not survive. Qingshan Tan, an economist at Cleveland State University in Ohio, says the longer the outbreak, the worse the economy.
You know, we already seen that the State Council has come out issuing the new edict that all the holidays will be postponed to after the February 8th. If that holiday extends further, then we're talking about probably the loss of 2 months worth of production, January and February. That could, have a long-term impact.
Tiang Lei Huang, a research analyst specializing in China at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, says an epidemic lasting until June would be a, quote, worst-case scenario, end quote. But he said even that may not drive China off its GDP goals.
So we know that China has a goal to double its GDP from 2010 to 2020. So this year is particularly important for China to reach that goal. A back-of-the-envelope calculation shows that this year China only has to achieve a 5.6% growth to achieve that GDP doubling goal. So that would be in line with people's expectation now that this year's GDP growth would be negatively affected by this coronavirus outbreak. We don't know how much exactly the GDP growth would be affected. Like I just said, the impact would be mostly concentrated in the first two quarters. So I guess the overall impact on the whole year growth would be smaller than people might fear at the time.
However great the impact is in China, just as the disease has now spread around the globe, infecting people in Asia, Europe, the United States, and Australia, any economic effects will likely cross borders too, says Huang. And now looking abroad to where else the coronavirus has spread, at least five people in Australia have tested positive. The latest is a young Chinese student diagnosed in Sydney. Australia is increasing its border and biosecurity measures. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Medical authorities are warning it's likely there will be more confirmed cases in Australia of the potentially deadly coronavirus. School children in New South Wales state have been told to stay away from class for 2 weeks if they've been in contact with a confirmed case of the disease. Symptoms of the virus include fever, difficulty breathing, and coughing. The coronavirus causes severe respiratory infection, and there is no cure or vaccine. Most of the deaths have been of those with pre-existing respiratory problems or the elderly. Doctors in Australia are being urged to wear protective face masks when seeing patients who potentially carry the coronavirus. It's thought to have originated in the Chinese city of Wuhan, the capital of Hubei province. Australia's chief medical officer is Professor Brendan Murphy.
We are starting to look at people who have come from parts of China other than Hubei as potentially at risk, although our focus still remains on that Hubei province of China, which is the epicentre and which is the only place where human-to-human transmission has been identified.
Australia is also bracing for a slump in visitors from China, its biggest international tourist market, because of restrictions put in place to try to stop the spread of the disease. The Australian government doesn't know how many of its citizens are caught in the vast quarantine lockdown area imposed by authorities in China. Reports have suggested that 100 Australians, including children, could be unable to leave. Coronavirus cases have also been confirmed in several countries, including Germany, Japan, South Korea, the United States, and Canada. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
U.S. President Donald Trump's defense lawyers wrap up their presentation in his trial on Tuesday. So far, they've ignored allegations that Trump told former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton he was withholding military aid to Ukraine until its government investigated his top election rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. In the coming days, the senators are expected to vote on whether to extend the trial by bringing in witnesses to testify. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson joins us now by phone to talk about what's been happening. Thanks for joining us, Catherine.
You're so welcome.
Can you first give us an update on Trump's defense team yesterday? What did they do?
So they really took a bit of a variety approach. They went through and picked a number of individual issues that have come up in the course of this case and threw each one of their defense attorneys out there to really drill down on the details of it. For example, Pam Bondi went and talked about the Joe Biden issue. We heard another defense attorney come out and discuss Rudy Giuliani, saying that he was really just a flashy distraction on the part of House impeachment managers who didn't really have a foundation to their case. So they don't really take a comprehensive approach so much as taking it apart bit by bit, piece by piece, to defend President Trump.
And what can we expect from the defense today?
We will expect a wrap-up of the defense, which I would expect would come with a lot of what we've heard already, which is that the president was completely within his rights to withhold aid to Ukraine because he was concerned about corruption. They argue that's what happened here, and that's completely within the rights of a president of the United States. I expect that we'll hear a reiteration of that, and maybe even possibly wrapping up early, as they mentioned when they started.
Now, do you think that any Democrats are going to be convinced by the Republicans' arguments?
I really don't think so, and that's because we're in such a... Impeachment all on its own is a very deeply divisive process. We know this, but more so in this political environment, and more so because we're holding an impeachment during an election year, which has never happened here in this country before. People are dug into their positions. They do believe them, but they're not going to be changing any minds here up on Capitol Hill.
All right, our last question. Have any more Republican senators flipped along with Utah Senator Mitt Romney regarding the issue of calling former National Security Advisor John Bolton to testify or any other witnesses to testify?
Well, there's been a range of reactions, not so much flipping as people slowly becoming open to the possibility that witnesses are going to be called in this trial. Even Lindsey Graham, we heard yesterday, he said, you know, look, if there's this book out there by Bolton, we need to see a copy of it. If it comes to it that we're holding a vote for witnesses, that's something that I would be open to. And I think, you know, knowing that Lindsey Graham is such a strong Trump ally up on Capitol Hill, that really says something that he's open to that possibility.
Thanks so much for coming on the show, Catherine.
You're so welcome.
That was VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson, here in Washington. VOA's International Edition continues. Among the top stories in the world, heavy storms and flooding in parts of Brazil have resulted in dozens of deaths and more than 25,000 people have been displaced. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson granted Chinese company Huawei a limited role in Britain's 5G mobile network on Tuesday, resisting U.S. pressure to exclude the telecoms giant over fears that Beijing could use its technology to spy. And in West Africa, authorities in Burkina Faso on Tuesday said up to 30 people were killed in an attack on a village by suspected Islamic extremists. This is International Edition.
The 62nd annual Grammy Awards show is coming up. To celebrate, Border Crossings will play songs from the winners of the 2019 American Music Awards to refresh you on some of last year's best tracks. Tune in to hear from your favorite artists like Post Malone, BTS, and Taylor Swift, January 23rd on The Voice of America.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On Friday, the United Kingdom formally withdraws from the European Union, more than 3 years after British citizens first voted in favor of the so-called Brexit to leave the EU. International Edition's Kate Pound Dawson spoke with journalist Catherine Field in Paris about what changes Europeans will wake up to on Saturday morning.
Very little, in fact, will change because it will all go into this transition period, which is supposed to last till the end of this year, but may go on longer. So first thing on Saturday morning, people will sort of look at one another and say, well, what's this? Because a lot of the trade will still be going on, planes will still be flying, there will still be the commerce going on. But what we will really see will be the negotiations getting going over where does everyone go from here? What will happen with residency? And I think we're going to start seeing quite a few, particularly British people, realizing this is it. They're leaving the European Union. And it will be the start of a very long process where, if you like, the European Union will slowly pull out of everything it does in the United Kingdom.
Now, there are going to be, as this plays out over the coming year, some economic impacts on both sides of the channel. London has become the biggest financial center outside of New York, and it's been dominating the European space. What's happening there?
There really is a bit of a race to grab those big investment banks that are at the moment based in London, based in the City of London, to get them to come to the European continent. And the race really is between Paris, particularly, who wants to see and has made a lot of moves into London to try and woo these bankers to come to Paris. And for that, the French president has put in a whole raft of tax incentives, of new visas for those companies and banking sector employees to be able to move to Paris. Frankfurt in Germany, the financial center there, is also trying to attract these companies, but they haven't really done as much as Paris has done, and so they are a bit behind. But you really are starting to see some of the long-term moves that the French government have been making to attract these people. For example, they've brought in new visa rules to make it easier for people who've got special banking skills to be able to come and move to France. Those sorts of initiatives to get them over here seem to have been paying big dividends. We've already got four or five big European-based American investment houses are already moved to Paris, and they're really expecting between now and the end of the year more to move over as well.
That was journalist Catherine Field in Paris speaking to VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Libya's unity government said Tuesday it had shot down an Emirati-supplied drone operated by forces led by Eastern Commander Khalifa Haftar near Misrata in western Libya. The Tripoli-based Government of National Accord said its, quote, anti-aircraft defenses, end quote, had shot down the drone east of Misrata, which is Libya's third largest city. The Government of National Accord on Tuesday posted images on Facebook showing what appeared to be a Chinese-made drone. Experts say Haftar has procured a number of the aircraft from his main backer, the United Arab Emirates. Haftar, who controls much of eastern and southern Libya, launched an offensive in April to seize the capital Tripoli in the country's northwest from the Government of National Accord. His advance stalled on the edge of the capital, but in early January, he captured the strategic coastal city of Sirte. The shootdown of the drone comes days after the United Nations slammed, quote, continued blatant violations, end quote, of a 2011 arms embargo, despite world leaders committing in mid-January to upholding the blockade. World powers and other countries with interests in Libya's civil war agreed at a January 19th meeting in Berlin to respect the UN arms embargo, hold off on military support to the warring parties, and push them to reach a full ceasefire. Although that Berlin conference put forward a roadmap for a political solution, the spokesperson of the Libyan National Army, Ahmed al-Mismari, said a military solution is the only solution to the Libyan crisis. The LNA is led by Khalifa Haftar. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Wolfgang Putzai, security analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, about the challenges facing efforts to reach a political solution in Libya.
There is absolutely no doubt about that after any military outcome of the current fighting, a political settlement will be required. Keeping the current military situation on the ground in mind, to me it sounds like Mismari is somehow desperate. But we need to be aware that many of the population in the east also demand a continuation of the fight. The oil terminal occupation also needs to be seen in this light. This was not only ordered by Haftar, this was also done by the local population. The ceasefire has been violated by both sides. Actually, on the day of the Berlin conference, several thousand Syrian mercenaries attacked in south-central Tripoli the LNA positions. And at the beginning, they were quite successful. After a couple of days, the LNA struggled to stabilize the front line, but they suffered severe casualties.
German Foreign Minister called Monday for countries that break the UN embargoes to Libya to face some consequences. Is that doable?
The embargo is in force since 2011, and there are already several UN resolutions demanding an enforcement of the embargo and this and that. And even the EU Maritime Operation Sophia had in its mission the enforcement of the weapons embargo. Not a single ship was intercepted. The arms embargo is since Berlin in particular violated by Turkey, but also by the other side. And there is no reason why the embargo should work now, keeping in mind that some of those violating it, Turkey, Emirates and so on, were sitting on the table in Berlin.
But German Foreign Minister said he was under no illusion that much work is still needed to put into practice decisions taken at a recent high-level meeting on Libya. He also expressed hope that the opposing parties in Libya would hold talks at the military level in coming days to firm up the truce. Would the two warring sides cooperate on that?
It is very likely that both sides will participate in these talks. The members for the delegations have already been nominated by the GNA and by the LNA. However, I would say an agreed ceasefire is unlikely for the time being, because on one side, the LNA still hopes that the Egyptians will balance the Turkish military intervention, and on the other side, the pro-GNA side will not agree until they are in a more favorable military situation on the ground. At least they want to take the outskirts of Tripoli, but probably also assume control over the oil crescent. Turkey's open intervention certainly changed the balance of power in the greater Tripoli area. They have deployed sophisticated air defense systems to Tripoli Maitiga Airport and to Misrata Airport. And this changed entirely the balance of power. The LNA Air Force was the backbone of the offensive of the Libyan National Army. And this Libyan National Army Air Force is now entirely neutralized. This means the prospects for the Libyan National Army to take Tripoli are not very good. I would say, in contrary, a defeat of the LNA is increasingly likely. And the pro-GNA side is aware of this.
President Trump discussed with Turkish President Erdogan the need to prevent regional intervention in Libya. Why the focus is on Turkish intervention and not on the continued intervention of Egypt and the United Arab Emirates in Libya?
There is a new dimension right now. For years, there was a covert support by Turkey and by Qatar on one side and by Egypt, the UAE, Jordan and some others on the other side. What has changed now, entirely now, is we have an open and massive intervention by one state, by Turkey. And this makes a local domestic conflict to an international armed conflict. Turkey is now officially a conflict party. And this brings a major risk of escalation. An Egyptian intervention is increasingly likely. And I would say at the latest, they will intervene when the pro-GNA side closes in on eastern Libya, to be more precise, on the oil crescent. The current issue is that the Turkish open intervention could lead easily to a full-fledged regional conflict. And this is exactly what scares so many states, including the United States. This is not so much about Libya anymore.
That was Wolfgang Putsai at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawy. You're listening to International Edition. This is the Voice of America.
You deserve some good, clean fun this weekend, right? I can help you get some. Hi, everybody. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. This weekend, tune in and relax and energize and connect with great music and people from across the African continent. You'll hear new urban music by artists like Alamok from Togo and Gwamba from Malawi, entertainment news, a live song of the week from Accra, Ghana.
Nice to be here.
And an exciting feature interview from Nairobi presenting a neo-traditional techno album, Sounds of Sasa. There's more too, and it's gonna be fun. So join me this Sunday and the following Saturday at 15:05 and 20:05 Universal Time.
The 62nd Annual Grammy Awards Show is coming up. To celebrate, Border Crossings will play songs from the winners of the 2019 American Music Awards to refresh you on some of last year's best tracks. Tune in to hear from your favorite artists like Post Malone, BTS, and Taylor Swift, January 23rd on The Voice of America.
Thousands of Palestinians demonstrated against U.S. President Donald Trump's Israeli-Palestinian peace plan on Tuesday, hours before its scheduled release at a ceremony in Washington. In Gaza City on Tuesday, protesters stepped on posters of Trump laid out on the ground. They waved Palestinian flags and held aloft posters of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Palestinian leaders have rejected the plan even before its official release. They say Trump's administration is biased toward Israel. The Palestinians fear the plan will dash their hopes for an independent state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, areas Israel captured in the 1967 war, by permitting Israel to annex large chunks of territory. Israeli leaders have welcomed Trump's plan, but the main political body representing Israeli settlers in the Israel-occupied West Bank is coming out against the plan because it reportedly includes the formation of a Palestinian state. Israeli troops have reinforced their positions near a flashpoint site between the Palestinian city of Ramallah and the Jewish settlement of Beit El in the occupied territory. Also in the area, vandals set fire to a Palestinian school and left behind graffiti in an attack that appears to have been carried out by Israeli settlers. Also Tuesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu withdrew his request for immunity from prosecution hours before parliamentary proceedings on the subject were to begin. He was indicted on counts of fraud, breach of trust, and bribery in November in three separate cases. He has denied any wrongdoing. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nadia Taha, our engineer, Nashwan Kale. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Have a great evening.